There are times when the church's set cycle of Bible readings for Sunday worship clashes jarringly with the events in our lives, and for us here, this is one of those weeks. At the recent funeral for baby Greta, I quoted the growly old prophet Athel Gill as saying that any version of the gospel that couldn't be preached in front of a mother grieving over the death of her children wasn't worth preaching at all. And today, that's very much our challenge, because Liesl and Dom are back with us for the first time since the funeral of their baby, and the lectionary throws up not just one, but two stories of miraculous interventions raising dead people to life and returning them to their grieving mothers. Even if we hadn't already buried Greta, none of us would be expecting a miracle to restore her to us. So what's the good news that we are to proclaim from these stories? I don't usually let people see my sermons before I preach them to them, but for obvious reasons, Liesl and Dom have seen this one. These events affect us all, and in the last fortnight, I've had pastoral conversations with quite a few of you for whom it has stirred up old griefs and or prompted serious faith questions about how such tragedies can happen to people who have been surrounded by the prayers of a faithful community offered to an all-good, all-loving God. Some of you have also mentioned the crippling illness that Paul and Merrill's granddaughter is facing. Where is God in such situations? And if God is good and we are faithfully praying, how come innocent children still suffer and die? Some of your painful questions have helped shape this sermon, so thank you. I'm going to focus more on these questions than on the Bible readings tonight, but it's hearing these readings at this particular time that forces the questions into such painful clarity. So I'm certainly not going to ignore the readings, and I want to start with a couple of general observations about them before focusing in on our questions. Firstly, the reason that these two stories come up together when they are so similar is because they are intentionally related to one another. Luke, the gospel writer, is deliberately alluding to the old Elijah story in the way that he tells his story about Jesus. And indeed, Luke has already told us about Jesus quoting the same story about the widow and her son at Zarephath in the sermon that nearly got him killed in Nazareth. Jesus quoted it when he was making the very unpopular point that God is just as willing to love and save foreigners as the Jews. And Luke lets us know here that Jesus' point hasn't really sunk in yet, because when Jesus raises the young man back to life, the people respond by saying, God has looked favourably on his people. They are still sure that God has favourites, and it was quite normal for religious people of that day to imagine that God would listen to their prayers and not the prayers of outsiders. And I'm sorry to say that is still a fairly widespread view. So at Nazareth, Jesus was seen as violating good and proper religious boundaries of clean and unclean, acceptable and unacceptable. And he's similarly unconcerned about such boundaries in tonight's story. Luke tells us that Jesus stepped forward and touched the wooden board on which the body was being carried to the burial ground. And that was something that people simply did not do. Only immediate family and the bearers would ever touch it, because to touch it made you ritually unclean. You can take the modern aversion to touching coffins and multiply it by about 100-fold. But Jesus has no fear of crossing this boundary and touching the dead. And his willingness to encounter death is important in another way also, because Luke is not only alluding back to the story of the widow in Zarephath, he is also alluding forward, because the next time his story introduces a widow grieving over the death of her son, the son will be Jesus himself. So among other things, Luke is emphasizing that Jesus is always ready to get intimately involved in the sufferings and tragedies of our lives and deaths. When death comes trampling into our lives, Jesus does not shrink back from touching it or being touched by it. But how come it comes trampling in at all? If God is all loving and all good and wants only the best for us, how come the world God has created is so constantly afflicted by random suffering and death? This is, of course, an enormous question that has occupied the world's best thinkers and filled shelves of books, and even if I had the answers, there's no way I could do it justice in a few minutes tonight. So I'm going to attempt little more than pointing in the direction of a few possible answers. There is one false answer that we cannot avoid because it comes up so often and it came up in one of these readings. Faced with the death of her son, the widow Zarephath turns on Elijah and says, "What have you got against me, O man of God? Have you come to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son?" And similarly, over and over, we hear people cry out, "What have I done to deserve this?" One of the things that such questions reveal is how desperately we want to believe in an orderly and fair universe where bad things only happen to those who deserve them. But if suffering only came as a punishment for wrongdoing, then we could keep ourselves and our families secure by being good. But despite all the religious voices that try to construct such a simple black and white universe, the Bible holds up Job and Jesus as living proof that evil and suffering are not under control and that goodness does not protect you from their random attacks. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but so far I've been leaving a line out of the usual way this classic question of suffering and evil is expressed. I've referred to God being all loving and all good, but usually the question also refers to God's power. Because, of course, we accept that plenty of people are loving and good, but lack the power to really change the way things are. But if God is all loving, all good, and all powerful, then surely God would both want to and be able to eliminate suffering and evil from the world. But there are two good reasons, both relevant to our questions tonight, why we might conclude that the idea of God being all-powerful may be misleading. Firstly, and most importantly, if we believe that Jesus is the primary and ultimate self-revelation of God, then that self-revelation, ending as it does in rejection, suffering, and a tortured death, is hardly one that demands the label of all-powerful. Jesus seemed to be much more on about, as the Apostle Paul put it, emptying himself of power. Which leads us to the second reason. Not only the revelation in Jesus, but perhaps even basic logic should probably be understood as pointing to the idea that in creating the world, God voluntarily relinquished the power to control everything that goes on in it. Why? Because God is love, and God created the world for love, and love and control are mutually exclusive. If God were to program the world so that nothing and no one could ever go wrong, and we all loved God not in freedom but because we were pre-programmed automatons who could not do otherwise, would that really be love? Could God take delight in such a relationship, in such love? Would any of us ever really want to create such relationships? If Liesl and Dom could be given a cast-iron guarantee that their next baby would be born safely and in perfect health, but only at the cost of its freedom, so that it was really a kind of robot that could only ever do what it was programmed to do for the rest of its life, would they choose to create such a baby? I doubt it. The cost would be too high. I'm sure they would rather take the risk again of creating a baby who will be free to become whatever it will become, which is the same risk that God took in creating us, in creating the world, voluntarily creating a universe that could not be pre-programmed and controlled, a universe that was free to go wrong. And unfortunately, that free universe has now been so damaged by so many generations of freedom used badly that all sorts of things go horribly wrong, and most of the causes are so clouded in the mists of time that they are impossible to unravel. God not only took the risk of creating a free world that could go wrong, God also took the risk of being left to wear the blame when it does go wrong. And so it is no sin to get angry at God and to shake our fists at heaven. In creating the world with such freedom, God willingly took on the responsibility for what happened next. God took the risk of being left to carry the blame for the damage done and the suffering caused by what was created. We rightly get disgusted by leaders who try to distance themselves from all responsibility for what is done by those beneath them. Let me assure you that God is not like that. God is willing and able to shoulder the blame and to allow us to vent our anger and anguish directly at God. When the son of the widow in Zarephath died, Elijah accused God of killing him and angrily demanded to know what God was playing at. And there is not the slightest hint in the story. I can actually still read this. We know that due to the rain, when the heavy rain happened during the week, it caused some problem with the earthing on one of the circuits. And I think it's just gone again. Sorry about the bizarre underneath illumination that's happening here. Oh, there we go. Back until it goes again. When Elijah accused God of killing this child and demanded to know what God was playing at, there is not the slightest hint in the story that God took offence or was angry or turned away from Elijah. And in the book of Job, Job makes lots of angry accusations against God for allowing undeserved suffering. And at the end, God says that Job is the only one who has spoken rightly of God. God is always ready to share our pain and to wear responsibility for it and to love us no matter what. Where does prayer fit into all this? What is the point of asking God to keep people safe and make people well if God doesn't have the power to control things? Does our faith and our prayer actually make any difference at all? Well, the simple answer is we don't know. But I probably need to elaborate on that at least a little. Even if it is true that God does not have the power to control everything and dictate every outcome, that does not mean that God does not have the power to influence anything or to act within situations in ways which might not be total control, but which might tip the scales in the right direction. Tonight's gospel reading is actually a challenge to anyone who says that praying with enough faith is the single key to ensuring God's response. You see, this story follows straight on from the one that we heard last week when the centurion prayed to Jesus with such perfect faith and his prayer was answered. But in this next story, the only faith expressed is by Jesus himself. Because neither the widow nor anybody else asks Jesus to do anything at all. Whatever it was that enabled Jesus to act with such power in this instance, it was not dependent on anybody else's faith or prayer. He just did it of his own accord. But that does not mean that our faith and prayer are irrelevant. Jesus clearly taught his followers to pray and to persist in prayer even when there seems to be no response. And so in line with last week's message about recognising Jesus' authority and doing what he says, whether we understand it or not, that is reason enough to keep on praying. But we can also trust that Jesus does not instruct us to do things that are meaningless and futile. We don't need to know how it works to trust that our praying participates in the Spirit's quest to overcome evil and suffering and to expand the reach of love and mercy and well-being. Even if it were nothing else, and I'm sure it is more, but even if it was nothing else than that changing the world begins with changing us and praying changes us, then that would be enough reason to know that prayer accomplishes important things. But I'm sure it is more than that. But much of the more remains largely in the realm of the mysterious ways of the Spirit. But that shouldn't surprise us, because isn't it the same with our communication with one another? We seldom understand why we can't get through to someone one day, and another day what is said seems to change everything. Communication is always an uncertain process. God is not a divine vending machine, but a living being who we will have even more trouble figuring out than all the other living beings who we try to relate to and communicate with. And there are lots of things that we do on faith and hope, but with very little understanding. I remember once when one of my dogs was very sick, the vet said to me, "You could give her this medication. There's some good anecdotal evidence that it often works, but we have absolutely no scientific understanding for why." Did I give it to him? Of course I did. And you can think of prayer for others as being much like that. It doesn't do any harm. It's too much of a mystery for us to be able to explain why it sometimes does good, but it seems clear that sometimes it does. And so the only time that it would ever be best to not keep praying is when God has already told you that he wants you to be the answer to the prayer and he's telling you to get off your knees and get on with it. We prayed and Greta still died. Does that mean that she didn't benefit from our prayers? No, it doesn't. And even less does it mean that our prayers were of no value to anyone at all. I don't know that I've answered too many questions or said anything terribly helpful here, but when you're grieving the death of a baby, nothing really makes much sense anyway. And most of what I've said is just kind of speculative theory, and it doesn't go anywhere near answering the agonised cries of why. But here at this table, speculative theory ends and a new reality begins. Here Jesus meets us in our brokenness. When there is nothing to say and no answers that mean anything, he reaches out and he touches us with the touch of life. Don't worry too much about theological answers. Instead, here at this table, prayerfully imagine yourself as the bereaved widow at the city gate of Nain, or even as the young man on the bier being carried out to his grave. Hear the breaking of hearts in the breaking of bread, and the splash of tears in the pouring of wine and water. And then allow Jesus to reach out, even when public opinion and religious sensibilities say that he shouldn't, to reach out, to touch you, and lift you up to something new. Even in the face of very real death, even when God doesn't answer the prayers that we most want answered or give us the life that we most wanted to receive, God is with us, meeting us in our grief, touching the untouchable, gathering our brokenness into his wholeness, and binding up our hearts with a love that keeps on being raised to new life.